Okay, in order for this verse to make any sense, I need to read the previous verse, because it starts with, I took this. So what does this refer to? So the previous verse was, once upon a time, this is Narada Muni speaking, once upon a time, my poor mother, when going out one night to milk a cow, was bitten on the leg by a serpent influenced by eternal time. And today's verse, I took this, in other words, the death of his mother, as the special mercy of the Lord who always desires benediction for his devotees, and so thinking, I started for the north. Purport. Confidential devotees of the Lord see in every step a benedictory direction of the Lord. What is considered to be an odd or difficult moment in the mundane sense is accepted as special mercy of the Lord. Mundane prosperity is a kind of material fever, and by the grace of the Lord, the temperature of this material fever is gradually diminished, and spiritual health is obtained step by step. Mundane people misunderstand it. Tada tad aham ishashya bhaktanam sham adipshata anugraham mana manyamana pratishtam disham uttaram. I took this meaning the death of his mother, as a special mercy of the Lord, who always desires benediction for his devotees, and so thinking, I started for the north. So here Prabhupada says that confidential devotees of the Lord see in every step a benedictory direction of the Lord. They see, in other words, that everything is for their benefit. Everything is good. So there are many different ways of looking at the world, but this particular way brings us to what Prabhupada talks about in the 20th chapter of Krishna Book, that to the materialist, everything is very aggressive, but to the devotees, everything is happily situated. So I know sometimes when I give that quote to people, they say, well, isn't it the opposite? Isn't it that the materialists think, oh, I'm happy, and the devotees see, no, life is very aggressive? I said, if that was the case, then why become a devotee? Prabhupada says, for the non-devotees, they think everything is aggressive. For the devotees, they see that everything is happily situated. So I'd like to look at four different ways of looking at the world and what happens to us. The first is people who, materially speaking, try to see good in everything that happens, from a material point of view. And there's so many stories like this. There's, of course, the story I'm sure you've all heard of the king who loses his finger. You've all heard that story? You haven't heard that story? So there was a king with his minister, and the minister says, you know, everything that happens is good, and then the king has some accident, loses a finger, and he says, this is nonsense. How is this good? I don't have my finger. You're lying. Puts the minister in jail. Later, the king is captured by some persons who engage in human sacrifice, and they're going to sacrifice the king, but when they see he's missing a finger, they say, oh, we can't sacrifice an imperfect specimen, so they let him go. And the king says to his minister, you were right. Everything that happens is good. He said, but I put you in prison. How is that good? And he said, well, if I had been with you, they would have sacrificed me. I'm not missing a finger. So this is looking at things from a material point of view, that everything that happens is leading to something good from a mundane perspective, that I'll become rich, famous, healthy, happy, you know, get my material desires fulfilled, and that the difficulties in life are simply meant to facilitate my getting my material desires fulfilled. That everything is working for the good in terms of material calculation. Do you think that this is a true philosophy? No, I don't think so either. But it's something that's very popular among materialistic people. Everything is for the good. Everything is for the good. But what do they mean by good? By good, they mean that they have a very happy and prosperous material life. Now, we can see objectively that not everybody has a happy and prosperous material life, and that not everything that happens to people leads to material happiness and material prosperity. Just objectively speaking, some things that happen to people lead to material misery and material poverty and material pain. So not everything is working on a material level for the good. That is simply not true. And people who try to see everything like that ultimately become cynical and disappointed. Now, sometimes people want to see everything as bad, right? This is what's called a world-negating philosophy. And I know that we have streaks of this within our Hare Krishna movement. We have, you know, highlights of this within our Hare Krishna movement. There are segments of our devotee population that see everything as bad. These are the people who argue with me when I quote this statement from Srila Prabhupada. They say, Urmila, you must have gotten it backwards. Prabhupada must be saying that the devotees see that everything is bad. And we tell, you know, there's nothing good in the world. Everything's terrible. Everything's bad. There's no enjoyment here. Everything is just awful. Even the good things are actually bad things. Right? We have this mind-body spirit meeting last night, and there were a few devotees there. And, oh my goodness. You know, some devotees just like don't have any common sense. I don't know. And one of them was saying, yeah, whenever we go in the world and we hear the mundane sounds, we just want to spit at them. And I'm like, oh my God. How are you going to attract people to Krishna consciousness if they think, well, if I come to Krishna consciousness, I'll simply hate everything in the world. Ah, that's bad. That's bad. That's bad. That's bad. That's bad. That's bad. So obviously that's not true either. Some people are rich. Some people are beautiful. Some people have happy families. I mean, Indrajumna Swami once told the story of how he met a man who claimed never to have gotten sick. I'm like, wow. Actually, I just recently saw a devotee in Croatia who had heart surgery, and he said this was the first time in his life that he'd ever gotten sick with anything, even a fever, runny nose, and he's like 50-something. So to say on a material level everything is bad, this is also just nonsense. And then to see duality. Now, of course, in the very beginning of our Krishna consciousness, seeing things in duality is very useful. To say this is material, this is spiritual. If we don't make that distinction in the beginning of our spiritual life, we won't be able to progress. We have to be able to say, okay, this is material and this is spiritual. Doing this thing is material, doing this thing is spiritual. That's matter, that's spirit. Yes? And in fact, we preach like that in the beginning. Okay, your body's material, you're spiritual, matter is bad, spirit is good. But what's the problem with continuing to see things like that? You won't be able to remember Krishna all the time. And one will also become affected by the things that Krishna tells us not to become affected by, happiness and distress, honor and dishonor, fame and infamy, friends and enemies. We'll be stuck in this idea of duality. So what is the proper way to see? Now again, seeing this is bad, this is good, is useful in the beginning. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Niyamagraha section of Bhaktiloka talks about that at different stages of bhakti, there's different rules. And he says, you shouldn't go too fast, you shouldn't artificially jump to a higher stage, but nor should you go too slowly. He says, if you remain attached to the rules of a lower stage when you're capable of progressing, then those rules will act as chains around your feet. So here Prabhupada's saying the confidential devotees, they see everything as spiritual and everything as spiritually good. They don't see everything as materially good or as materially bad, but they see everything as spiritual and everything as spiritually good. Now, why can't you do that on the lower stage? Because on a lower stage, you'll think smoking cigarettes is spiritual. You understand? Oh, everything's spiritual. So gambling is spiritual, meat eating is spiritual, cigarettes are spiritual. Right? It will be a catastrophe, yes? Everything is spiritual. Everything is spiritually good. One won't understand. Just like, you know, when I would teach little children, so when you teach 5- and 6-year-olds, you say you cannot subtract a bigger number from a smaller number. You cannot do 3 minus 5. If they write 3 minus 5, you say, that's wrong. That's all you say. That's wrong. You can't do that. But at a certain point, we teach them that you can do 3 minus 5, isn't it? In fact, people do it all the time on their credit cards. Yeah? Or with English, I used to have to tell the children, never start a sentence with the word because. Because, if they start a sentence with because, they will write a fragment. Now later, you can teach them about independent and dependent clauses. Sorry if you have some, if I'm triggering some memory of a grammar teacher you didn't like. But later you can teach them about dependent and independent clauses, and that is perfectly acceptable to start a sentence with because. However, when somebody's 6 years old, 5 years old, 7 years old, you have to say, no, that's not allowed. I'm thinking about how Prabhupada told one devotee, you're getting too fat, you should reduce your eating. And the devotee said to Prabhupada, but Prabhupada, when I came to Krishna consciousness, you told me to eat a lot. And Prabhupada said, well, did you believe me then? He said, so believe me now. So we should come to a point where we become a confidential devotee. And where we see sarva kalam idam brahma, everything is spiritual. Not the way that the impersonalists see. They don't see the variety. But we know that within spirit there is variety, but all the variety is good and it's all spiritual. So there's a talk Prabhupada gives on the nectar devotion where three times he says, there is no material world, there's no material world, there's no material world. And if I were really prepared for today's class, I'd have that and play it for you. He says, the devotee sees there's no material world. They see everything as spiritual. Now, from a philosophical, logical point of view, what do we mean by that? Because very obviously, this table is not conscious of itself. Spiritual must mean Satchidananda, yeah? You have an idea? You want to suggest something? Everything can be used for the service of Krishna. Okay, in that sense, it's spiritual. And Srila Prabhupada talks about that sense of spiritualizing matter in his purport to 424. But he also talks about something else, besides using everything for the service of Krishna. Yeah. Everything is energy of Krishna. Let's think about what that means. So normally we think of spiritual as meaning Satchidananda, eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. Well, this table is not conscious, right, of itself. Is this table aware of itself? No. I'm aware of my existence. This table is not aware of its existence. And this table will not eternally exist in the form of a table. In fact, its form of a table is very, very temporary. And the table is certainly not experiencing happiness. It's not experiencing anything in particular. So you could say, I'm experiencing emotions. I'm eternal, right? I have knowledge of my existence. Therefore, I am spiritual. The table is material. However, the table is also part of Krishna's energies. And it's part of his body. Which body is it part of? The Viratrupa. It's part of his universal body. Yes? Everything is part of the universal body of the Lord. And there's a lot in the Bhagavatam dedicated to meditation on the universal body of the Lord. Now, if it's part of the universal body of the Lord, is the Lord conscious of this table? The Lord is absolutely conscious of this table. The table's not conscious of itself. In that way, it's a different energy from me, the Jivatma, who's conscious of myself, but the Lord is conscious of the table. Now, is the Lord conscious of the table the way that I'm conscious of the table? I'm aware of the table because I can see it and I can touch it. Or is the Lord conscious of the table because it's part of him? Yes, he's in every atom. So is the Lord conscious of the table the way I am? I can see it, I can touch it, I can hear it. Or is he conscious of it the way I'm conscious of my fingernails? Yes. Now, my fingernails, I just cut them so there's not much of that outside part. But, you know, the outside part is dead, right? That's why when you cut it, you don't feel pain. But are you conscious of it? Are you conscious of the outside part of your fingernails? Sometimes you see these ladies with these humongous nails. I mean, nowadays, usually they're fake. But sometimes you see them with these really long, real nails. Are they conscious of that dead part of the nail? Yeah, they are, actually. You see, like, when they're using their phone, they have to move their fingers in some weird way. Or your hair, you know, unless you don't have any shiko or any hair at all. So all of us have some hair that's not directly in the scalp, yeah? Like I have my bun. So that part of your hair is dead, right? But are you aware of it? Are you aware of it? A little bit, to some extent. Okay, so although this is dead matter, Krishna is conscious of it. He is aware of it. When I touch the table, when I touch the floor, he is aware of it just as I would be aware if you bumped up against my hair. Huh? Does that make sense to everybody? Yes. Does he have any emotion in connection with this table? He has some. Like you're saying, using it in Krishna's service, that means Krishna cares what we do with it. It matters to him. How we use the table can make him happy or disappointed. And is the energy of the table eternal? The table as a table is not eternal, but the energy is eternal. So everything is spiritual. Everything is spiritual. And Krishna is Suridam Sarvabhutanam. He is the best friend of everyone. So everything has a benefactory, kind intention. We are within the body of the Lord. Just like, you know, I have a cells within my body. Am I the benefactor of the cells within my body? I'm not? I hope so. Unconsciously. But I am. I want my skin to be healthy. I want my heart to be healthy, right? Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj asked Srila Prabhupada, he said, when we take prasadam, do we benefit all the jivas that are in the cells of our body? And Prabhupada laughed and laughed. He said, you are so merciful. You are thinking of benedicting the little creatures in your body. You know. But it's a fact. I care. Whatever I do, I mean, unless I'm a really mode of ignorance person, whatever I do for the benefit of all the cells in my body. I want them to be happy. Right? Don't you want at least your stomach to be happy? Yeah? Nobody wants an unhappy stomach. I don't want unhappy lungs. I don't want unhappy legs. I want all the cells in my body to be happy. Of course I do. So Krishna wants all of us to be happy. Of course he does. And everything that he does is for our happiness. Now Krishna is not very concerned about our illusory happiness. That's not of very much interest to him. Just like I had some friends who, devotee friends, whose son became a heroin addict. So they weren't particularly interested in facilitating his heroin addiction. They didn't want him to have some sort of illusory happiness. They wanted him to give up heroin addiction and have real happiness. So Krishna, being concerned for our real happiness, sometimes shakes up our illusory happiness. Just like if we had some cells in our body that became cancerous and they were really happy dividing like crazy. I'm really happy dividing like crazy. We wouldn't want those cells to be happy, would we? In that way. We'd want them to be happy in a healthy way. We'd want to stop their illusory happiness, which was making us sick. And we would want to contribute to their real happiness. So if Krishna sees that some of his parts and parcels are becoming happy in an illusory way, in a cancerous way. In a way that's causing our own destruction and causing difficulty in the social body, then he may try to stop that to restore us to health. And if we're in illusion, we may perceive such actions as aggressive. Like the heroin addict's son, his parents said, "You're not allowed in the house," because he would steal their money to buy heroin. And he might see that as inimical. You don't love me anymore. You're not letting me in your house. Sometimes if we're sick, we might fast. And the cells in our body, they don't understand what we're doing. The little cells in my heart, the little cells in my brain, they're just like, "Help, help, I'm not getting anything to eat." But actually, I'm doing it for their benefit. So Prabhupada says here, materialists misunderstand when the temperature is being reduced. If there's a fever in my body, maybe I'm going to fast. Maybe I'm going to take some bitter medicine. And the little cells, they don't understand. Why aren't I getting any food? Why am I getting something bitter? They think that I'm no longer their well-wisher. But the fever needs to be reduced. Prabhupada talks about a funny story about this very wealthy lady who was sick with a fever, and her servant was also sick with a fever. And the doctor came and said, "Oh, the servant has a very high fever. She needs these medicines and this treatment, but you, the wealthy lady, the mistress of the house, you have a very slight fever. You don't have to do very much." She says, "How is it? My servant has a higher fever than I have. How dare you say my fever isn't as high as my servant's?" So in material illusion, we may become attached to activities and situations which are actually causing our spiritual disease, which are causing us to not be able to progress spiritually and become genuinely happy. Sometimes we're aware, and sometimes we're not aware. Sometimes we know, yes, I have this particular attachment, I have this particular problem, I'm struggling with this thing, I'm not able to give it up myself, I'm not able to deal with it myself, it's hurting my progression. Sometimes we're aware of those things. And other times we're not. Other times there are things we're doing or thinking or behaving that are spiritually detrimental, and we think they're wonderful. You know, last time I was here, I was teaching Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha. I've now taken the metaphors of Manashiksha and Jed Bharat's metaphors and Lord Chaitanya's metaphors and written a devotional novel based on those. But in Raghunath Das Goswami's metaphors for Manashiksha, he talks about the thieves that have ropes around our neck, these thieves of lust, anger, fear, envy, that pull us with these ropes to do things that we know are wrong. We know, you know, I shouldn't do that, I shouldn't watch that, I shouldn't eat that, and we do it anyway. Arjuna talks about this problem in the third chapter. So we have those problems, we know they're wrong. We know we're not supposed to criticize devotees, and we go, "Well, you know I really shouldn't say this, but..." We do it anyway. You know, so those are the things that we know are wrong. We're aware that they're wrong. We're struggling with them. We're not sure how to deal with them. And then his other metaphor is the donkey urine bath. Any of you guys remember that from Manashiksha? So the donkey urine bath is where we think we're doing something good. We think we're cleaning ourselves. We think, "This is spiritual. This is Krishna conscious. This is beneficial for me." And actually, it's a bath in burning donkey urine. Then instead of cleaning us, is polluting us. And we're deceiving ourselves. We're not even aware that we're doing something in opposition to Krishna consciousness. And we see this phenomena on a society-wide level. We see some institutionalized donkey urine baths. And then we see it on an individual level. So in Manashiksha, Raghunath Das Goswami talks about this, and Bhakti Vinod, in his commentary, he talks about several examples of how one can be bathing in donkey urine, but being charmed by that bath and thinking, "Yes, I am getting clean." Right? And when someone says, "Hey, you're bathing in donkey urine," we become angry. "No, this is my Krishna consciousness, Prabhu. I'm becoming purified." And even with the thieves with the rope around our neck, we may become angry. If someone says, hey, you shouldn't be watching the movie. Well, I need some relaxation time. Get off my case, you fanatic. Even then we may become angry, even with the things we know are wrong. And at the same time, we're saying, Krishna, Krishna, please, I want pure devotional service. Hare Krishna, please engage me in your service. Please take away all my illusion. Please give me pure devotional service. Krishna's like, well, okay. You're asking me for pure devotional service, and then you don't want to get rid of the things you know are wrong, and you certainly don't want to get rid of the things you're justifying to yourself. So what am I going to do? So Krishna may manipulate our lives so that we see, as Prabhupada said, the naked form of material attachment. He may facilitate us doing what we really want, what we're asking for all the time. I want eternal, unlimited happiness. And he may say, you know, as long as you're doing this, it's not going to work. So he will put us in circumstances which we should note very carefully do not force us. Was Narada forced to travel to the north and leave home and become like a mendicant when his mother died? Was he forced? No. Now he didn't know who his father was. He only had his mother. I don't know if he, and Prabhupada said that's all he had. But, you know, maybe he could have found some other family to live with and gone on with life, right? He didn't have to say, the death of my only support is indicative that I should take shelter of the Lord. He didn't have to. It was still a choice. So even when Krishna puts us in situations where he's shaking our attachments, our known and unknown attachments, we do not have to respond with surrender. But we have a good opportunity to do so. Now, by the way, does Krishna have to kill our mother in order for us to surrender? No. Do you think he likes to do things that way? No. Would you? Only if it was required. I was struggling with a health problem for many years, which, thank you, Krishna, has now been resolved. And anyway, I was having a whole bunch of tests done. And when I was meeting with the surgeon, he was looking over the test. He said, well, I'm sorry to inform you that the tests indicate that you're not a good candidate for surgery. Surgery isn't going to help you. But it was actually those tests that revealed to me what I should do, so it was very wonderful. But then he looked at me. It was going to be surgery on my stomach. So he starts looking at my abdomen. Can you imagine this? A surgeon looking at your abdomen. And he looks at me like I was, you know, a plate of his lunch. And he says, you know, I love to do surgery. He said, I really enjoy it. That's why I became a surgeon. He said, I would like nothing better than to cut you up. Can you imagine? Somebody staring at your belly. It was kind of disconcerting, you know. I was kind of wondering if I should leave the room. I was looking around, is there a scalpel in the room, you know? He said, but it's not the proper treatment for you. He said, you don't need such an aggressive treatment. You can get well in another way. So certainly Krishna would prefer to have a less aggressive treatment, isn't it? Even this guy who loved cutting people up, he would prefer to recommend a less aggressive treatment. So I give the analogy all the time. When Krishna wants his cows to move from one place to another, what does he do? He calls them by name. He has his japa beads. You know that? Krishna has japa beads. It's in Krishna book. They're made out of what? Anybody know what they're made out of? Not tulsi, no. Precious stones. They're made out of jewels. And he chants the name of the groups of cows. So in the spiritual world, there are also groups. Sometimes all the devotees are together, but usually people hang out with their own group. This is really a side point, but one devotee recently in Barcelona said, you know, I don't like 85% of the devotees. I said, you know, Prabhupada told Jamuna and Dinatarni, if you're with one other person who's compatible, you can make advancement. But if you're with 200 who are not compatible, nobody makes any advancement. And even in the spiritual world, there's groups. There's groups of coward boys. There's groups of gopis. There's groups of cows. Sometimes they're all together, like under Govardhan Hill, and all the gopis do Ras Lila together. But generally, people hang out, the living entities, the pure devotees, they hang out with a group that's compatible with them. Anyway, so Krishna calls, that's a very side point, Krishna calls his cows by group. And if he won't come when they call, when he calls his names, then what do you think he does next? No, that's the last thing. Plays his flute. If they don't come for the flute, what do you think he does next? Not yet, no. He has a buffalo horn. Then he has a stick. He also has a rope. So Prabhupada writes in the first canto that Krishna's regretful when he has to punish someone. Aren't we like that? I mean, unless we're sadistic. Parents don't enjoy punishing their children. It's a last resort. Hey, can you please stop hitting your brother? Put the toy down. You know, finally, you grab the toy away from them. All right, timeout. But you don't want to put them in a timeout. You know, it's not your pleasure to do that. You would like it if the children behaved when you asked them nicely. Every parent, you know, I think, again, unless you're really wacko, every normal parent, we'd love it if we said to our children, this is the proper way human beings should behave. Please do it. And that was it. It never happens, but, you know, that's what we would like. And Krishna would like that with us, too. If he says, you know, sarva dharmam prachajam may kam sharanam rajam, we go, oh, okay. Prabhupada said we could become Krishna conscious in a moment. So Krishna doesn't have to resort to these extreme measures, having people die, having our house burned down, getting cancer, getting thrown out of a temple, you know, all these extreme measures. He doesn't need to resort to them, and he doesn't even like to resort to them, but sometimes it's the only thing that we'll respond to. So our first takeaway from here is respond to Krishna when he's gentle. And the next thing to take away from here is when there is something extreme, respond to it as kindness. So I just wanted to end with a list of people in the Shastra, or that we know of, great devotees, confidential devotees, that had a circumstance that seemed horrific, and they responded to it as Krishna's kindness. Now, before going this list, we should note that many times devotees think that if a person surrenders or becomes world-renounced or takes to a renounced ashram because of some horrific situation, that their renunciation wasn't real. That the only real renunciation is if everything's going wonderfully in your life and you become more renounced and surrendered anyway. But both are real. If we respond to Krishna's gentle indications by becoming more surrendered, more renounced, more devoted, that's real. And if we respond to Krishna's heavy duty, knock you off your feet, your whole world collapses situations by becoming more renounced and more surrendered and more devoted, that's also real. It's not that it's only real if it's nice or if it's only real if it's awful. So let's look at some. We have Vidura. Vidura was in a situation where Duryodhan threatened him. He said, beat this son of a maidservant and leave him with only his breath. In other words, beat him practically to the point of death. And Vidura's like, oh, time to get out of here. And he took Vanaprastha to travel to the holy places. Srila Prabhupada, when his wife bought Karmi tea biscuits by selling his Bhagavatam, it's like, okay, time to go. Bibhishan, when Ravana threatened to arrest him for his advice, it's time to go. Prabhupada actually said Bibhishan at that point took sannyas, although it didn't end up like that because Ram gave him the kingdom and he was reunited with his family. But that was his mood. I'm giving up everything, I'm giving up my family, giving up the kingdom, surrendering to Rama. Venu, when Venu was so cruel, when little Venu was so cruel, Anga just gave up the kingdom, left in the middle of the night. So nobody could talk him out of it. How Lord Ramachandra related to Kaikeyi and Dasarath's banishment of him to the forest. How Parikshit related to the curse when Sringi cursed him. Vitrasura was welcoming Indra defeating him. Oh, this is my chance to go back to Godhead. This is my chance to be with Krishna. So we have many, many examples. I'm sure you can all think of many more. There's many examples in the Shastra and of contemporary devotees where some kind of catastrophe, some kind of terrible situation, they saw this is also a benediction. Prabhupada actually writes, like about Maharaj Parikshit, that Krishna saw he was too attached to kingdom and family. And that's why he arranges. So sometimes when Krishna sees that we won't respond to the gentle touch, then he uses something very extreme. Also, the benefit of something extreme is that nobody can criticize. You know, if you just hear Krishna's gentle calling and you make some big change, people will say, oh, you're being irresponsible or this or that. I mean, I had an interesting circumstance. I was doing some service and it became very clear to me that Krishna didn't want me to do that service anymore. I mean, it was just abundantly clear. And so I told the other devotees I was working with, you know, I need to give this up and move on, do something else. And everyone except one person accepted it. There was one person who said, no, you have to keep doing it, whatever, just fight through the obstacles. And And so sometimes everybody's saying that. Sometimes everybody's saying, you just have to stick here anyway, even though it's killing you. And so then sometimes Krishna arranges some catastrophe, and then everyone says, yes, 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 okay. It's time for a change. And there's also many examples in the Shastra of people who got gentle indications. With Raghunath Das Goswami leaving home, it was nothing catastrophic that happened. Or Rupa and Sanatan renouncing their position. There was no catastrophe. But just simply attraction, something gentle, something sweet. They said, okay, now it's time to give this up, or now it's time to accept this, now it's time to move on, now it's time to make a change. So we should come to the level of being confidential devotees, where we actually can see that everything is spiritual. We are part of the body of the Lord. That everything that happens to us is for our benediction, is for our good. Not necessarily materially speaking. Not necessarily from a material point of view. But is for our ultimate spiritual good. And to respond to every situation, the so-called nice material situations, the so-called bad material situations, the gentle nudges from Krishna, the heavy stick from Krishna, as, oh, here is my good friend. As Prabhupada said when he saw the bombs falling, he said, here's the universal form, you know. Here's my good friend. Here's Krishna, Suridam, my most well-wishing friend, communicating with me and giving me an opportunity to become more surrendered. And frankly, this principle is not just about the big things. Prabhupada says Krishna is giving us an opportunity imperceptibly 24 hours a day. So everything that's happening now, here, now, in this room, and the next now, and the next now, at every moment, Krishna is benedicting each of us. He's the well-wisher of each of us. Who we meet, where we are, as Prabhupada wrote a letter to Jayapataka Maharaj, surrender to Krishna means knowing whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. Let me do it with full attention to every detail. Let me concentrate on it completely. All other considerations be forgotten, and do it for Krishna's alone pleasure be my motive. So this mood of surrender, of letting go of my idea of good and bad. If I've given my life to Krishna, whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. Let me give it. Let me give full attention to all detail, fully concentrated on what that is, without forgetting all other considerations, simply, how can I please Krishna in this situation? And then, Premanjana Tarita Bhakti Vilochanena Santasadaiva Radiyeshu Kayanti Yam Shaima Sundaramachintra Gunaswarupam. We will see Krishna everywhere. And as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita 4:24, everything becomes Brahman. We experience everything as spiritual, which in fact it is. So I just want to mention that I brought a few copies of my book here. If any of you would like to get a copy of after the class, we have a special rate, 1 for 10, 2 for 15. You can also get it on Amazon, where it's there in Kindle and audiobook. It's on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon as an audiobook. And it's a journey from materialistic life to Krishna Prema. So it deals with beginning topics all the way up to very high topics, but in language that's for the general public. So you can give it to family, friends, coworkers who are not devotees. I actually had non-devotee editors working with me with the books. But the senior devotees I've given to, even sannyasis, have written me that when they read it, they were crying in happiness. So we do have just a few copies here in London if you'd like one after the class. So any questions, comments, additions, subtractions, corrections, chastisements?